The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 3, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Well, good morning, everyone. This morning, I'm going to give a talk that I've titled Nothing Missing, which is kind of funny because I have to admit when I sit and I talk to the computer screen, even though I can see you and it's wonderful, I still feel like I'm missing you. You know, I feel like I'm missing you in the room, and that feeling is very real. And I think we live in a time right now where we feel like some essential needs are not being met because of, well, whatever they might be, they could be emotional needs that we have. We might have a sense of feeling isolated or disconnected. These are words that I've heard people use in the last few weeks now. Or we might have physical needs that aren't being met. And I'll tell you right now that before there were any stay-at-home orders, I'd started hearing jokes on Facebook. I might have mentioned this in my last talk if I did, forgive me. But I was kind of amused by it because people were talking about how all the toilet paper in the grocery stores was being purchased. And I didn't really think anything of it until, you know, I just thought I'd look one day in the store to see what people were talking about. And sure enough, the whole aisle of toilet paper was empty. There's just not a single thing in the aisle. And every week that I went to the grocery store after that, I would look down the toilet paper aisle and it would be completely empty for weeks. It wasn't until last week that I finally saw my first rolls of toilet paper in a store. So you might need some toilet paper and doesn't seem to be there. So we look at these things that seem to be missing right now, either you sitting in the Zendo, or that maybe a sense that we're not connecting with people we love or just friends, or that we're not getting the things that we want. And then we might tell ourselves, you know, if it wasn't for COVID-19, those necessary needs would be met. If it wasn't for the stay-at-home order, maybe I wouldn't be having the problems that I'm having. And we know this. This is probably familiar. Maybe you don't feel quite that strongly about some of this, but you do kind of look at the way your life seems to have been disrupted, and you look at COVID-19, and you start to locate blame in COVID-19 for the things that you're missing. But in doing that, what we're actually talking about are just the circumstances that are showing up right now. And if we pay attention, those circumstances are always changing, even within the pandemic of COVID-19, of the coronavirus. Even that changes from moment to moment how it is we're experiencing that. And sometimes this experience, if it can be very rich, can be very fulfilling. I know I mentioned last time that I was really happy to see so many people out and walking in my neighborhood. And I still really enjoy seeing that. There are still lots of people out in my neighborhood. And so sometimes it can feel rich. Heck, I've been cooking a lot. I do cook anyhow, but I seem like I have more opportunities to cook than ever before. And I was just thinking the simple pleasure that I got from making stuff that lasted a lot of meals. I made a minestrone soup in it. That's going to be a 5-meal soup. Right. So there's some pleasures that we can have within this experience. The circumstances are always changing. But if it weren't for COVID-19, I wouldn't be feeling this way, or I wouldn't be missing that thing that I normally have. And what we're really doing is we're taking our ideas about previous circumstances and we're applying them to the current circumstances. In other words, what we're doing is we have this sense that whatever those needs were that we now feel like are missing, whatever those were that were being taken care of before, at least we think they were being taken care of before, we now look at our current circumstances and say, I don't have that anymore. Rather than seeing what's actually showing up, we're taking a different situation, we're putting it into, at least our ideas about a different situation, we're putting them into now, and then we're evaluating and judging now by that previous circumstance, that previous situation. We actually do this all the time, but you really notice it when you feel that something is missing, that sense that something is not there, something that you need to get or get back. Now, I'm going to ask that you bear with me in some of the examples that I'm going to provide to you to help illustrate and talk about this sense of something missing. But I'm going to talk about responses to literature that I've heard from various students over the years. I don't know if you are aware, but just to let you know, I was an English teacher at a community college for about 10 years. And so I heard, I encountered a lot of stuff. Literature is very important to me. And I do see that the ways that we encounter any kind of writing, any kind of culture is actually the way that we're encountering the world. So the way we talk about that is actually reflective of the ways that we think about and talk about the world that we live in. So I want to start with an example of this something missing with a story about a young man that I heard about who had started a thread on Reddit. And Reddit seems to be a place where you could start these kinds of threads where people just like to get into it, so to speak. Now, I didn't really know about this thread, but I had a former student and was really a wonderful student, but he was also a very contentious student. So no matter what I would do, he would start debating with me in class. And I will say this, one of the things I had him read was George Orwell's essay, Politics in the English Language, which is a really excellent essay. In every class we talked about that essay, he would argue with me about what a dumb essay it was. And then many years later, I saw on his Facebook page, he posted the fact that he thought every freshman in college should be assigned George Orwell's Politics in the English Language essay. So I was kind of flattered and I pointed out to him how much he hated it when he'd originally read it. But I tell you this because it was this student, this contentious student, who told me about this Reddit thread that was starting. And what the thread was is a young man had been assigned to read The Catcher in the Rye for a literature class, and he didn't like it. So the Reddit thread basically was, you know, I really didn't like Catcher in the Rye. What am I missing? And he wanted people to kind of come up with reasons why The Catcher in the Rye is a book that is, I don't know. I mean, I think he's talking about liking or not liking, but he's conflating that with literature. But make a case for me. Why should I be liking this? What is it that I'm missing? And I did write a response to my former student. I didn't put it on the Reddit thread. And I'll tell you what that response is later in the talk. It was a bit curmudgeonly. I tend to be a bit of a curmudgeon. So it was a bit of a curmudgeonly response, but it was also meant to be a bit provocative too, because it seemed to me that whether or not I thought The Catcher in the Rye was any good really didn't matter. It really didn't matter. And what that student wanted was somebody to kind of turn him around a little bit, to show him what it was he was missing, to give him that thing that he thinks is missing. And that to me was more interesting, was that question of, what am I missing? What am I missing? Because that seemed to me that that's a question that all of us can relate to. At some point or another in our life, we go, what am I missing? Now, it might show up in a slightly different way. We might say something's missing. It might be a sense that something is missing right now. And we're trying to figure out what that something is. We're trying to fill it. And it could be, what am I missing? You get the sense that it should be right there. The Catcher in the Rye's literary worth should be right there, but it's obfuscated. It's hidden from me. And we say that about reality. What am I missing? What is, you just have the sense that something is missing. And we're talking about dukkha here. And dukkha is that sense that we have that something right now is not right. That something is missing. Something is awry. Now, to me, it's interesting that what I've been starting to do here is I'm talking, what am I missing? And something's missing. I'm conflating the two because I think that they do work together. That sense, what am I missing? Now, on one hand, I have a feeling that the person that started that Reddit thread is basically saying, I'm not missing anything. There's really nothing here. Emperor's New Clothes, folks. The Catcher in the Rye just is not a great book. I think there was an element of that to it. But he was maybe open to be convinced that there was something he was missing. But that sense that we have that something, that we're missing something, we very quickly turn into something's missing here. There's something missing in this world. So what we see is happening. If we look at that, what am I missing? Something's missing. Is that our feelings that are arising, we kind of project those onto the world. We take a look at our subjective experience, we project that onto the world, and we get a sense that I feel like something's missing, I'm missing something. And that very quickly can become a sense that there's just something's not there for us, something we need to get. I'd like to read a passage from Shunryu Suzuki from his classic book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that touches on how it is that we can very quickly dismiss, well, not really dismiss, but feel like something is not there in our experience, that we're missing out on something, and we're missing out on something because there's really nothing there. There's really something missing in what it is that we think we're encountering. So he talks about this mountain in China. In Japan, they call it Rozan. In China, it's Mount Lu or Lushan. But I'll use the term Rozan. It's what Shunryu Suzuki uses. And here's what Suzuki wrote. He says, in China, Rozan is famous for its misty scenery. I have not been to China yet, but there must be beautiful mountains there. And to see the white clouds or mist come and go through the mountains must be a very wonderful sight. Although it is wonderful, a Chinese poem says, Rozan is famous for its misty, rainy days and the great river Seko for its tide, coming and going. That is all. That is all, but it is splendid. This is how we appreciate things. So you should accept knowledge as if you were hearing something you already knew. But this does not mean to receive various pieces of information merely as an echo of your own opinions. It means that you should not be surprised at whatever you see or hear. If you receive things just as an echo of yourself, you do not really see them. Do not fully accept them as they are. So when we say Rozan is famous for its misty rainy days, it doesn't mean to appreciate this site by recollecting some scenery we have seen before and say to ourselves, it is not so wonderful. I have seen that site before, or I have painted much more beautiful paintings. Rozan is nothing. This is not our way. If you are ready to accept things as they are, you will receive them as old friends, even though you appreciate them with new feeling. So I really like this passage from Shunryu Suzuki because he touches on a number of things. But the first one is that sense, here you have Rozan. And if you've seen misty mountains, you know, they have a certain atmosphere to them. They have a certain, you can almost say like romantic aura about them. At least that's the way we might think of them. What this Chinese poem that Suzuki's pointing out says, well, you know, it's famous for its misty rainy days and for the tide of the river coming and going. But if you go there, that's all that's there. It's just misty mountains. It's just a river with the tide coming and going. And we might do that. We might compare this again. As Suzuki says, we might point this out that we've seen sites like this before. And Rozan's nothing special. I've been to a canyon before. The Grand Canyon's not as great as the canyon near my house, you know, whatever it might be, where we take this other experience we have and we compare it to the experience we're having right now, and then we find something lacking or missing in the experience that we're having right now. I think one of my favorite things actually is where Suzuki says, I have painted more beautiful paintings. I've actually created more beautiful images than this. What he tells us is that that is not our way, to take what is showing up now and to compare it with some previous experience and then to evaluate it based on that. Instead, he says, you should accept knowledge as if you were hearing something you already knew. And that knowledge he's talking about right here, this is not intellectual knowledge. This is just knowing. This is just experience. You should accept this knowing of Rozan afresh. He does say, as if you were hearing it, as if you were hearing something you already knew. And I want to talk about that because it sounds as if he's saying, as if you were hearing something you already knew, that you pretend as if you were hearing something you already knew. But he's not saying that. He's not saying, pretend that you have this experience. He's encouraging you, welcoming you to see how in this experience, what your experience is, what is always there. An experience. It's absolute experience that's taking place there. And again, what we'll do is we'll conflate the changing scenery, the circumstances, the COVID-19. We conflate that with our direct experience. Meanwhile, direct experience is right there. It's the friend we have, and it's showing up right now as me talking to my computer monitor. Right? That's how it's showing up right now. So the scenery changes. We have relative reality, and that's always changing. Things to seem to come and go. But then we have this aspect of experience, of reality, that is absolute, that is here, always here. To have to perceive, not to perceive, it's always here. It's direct experience. That's what it is that we overlook, is that direct experience in the manifestation of reality that's showing up. So we get caught up in the things and we overlook the direct experience. We overlook the knowledge that we already have. So Suzuki's inviting us when we have these experiences, even though you appreciate them with new feeling, even though the circumstances are always changing, always new, you accept them as if you were hearing something you already knew. You're recognizing in them the absolute. You're not just getting hung up on the relative, on the conditioned. Because if you do that, then you start getting caught up in comparing this particular thing to that particular thing. You know, when I was reading that Suzuki passage again, it reminded me of when I was a kid and we'd go on vacation and you would drive. In my case, it was like in a station wagon, one of those paneled station wagons. And my stepdad, guy driving a car, he smoked a pipe and all the windows would be rolled up. So, I mean, the journey would be this arduous. You know, when you're a kid, and you're going to, say, Mount Rushmore, and it's going to be like a six-hour drive or an eight-hour drive. First of all, that already feels like an eternity. But then do that in a car where there's pipe smoke just sort of billowing, right? You know, so you put all that work into getting to Mount Rushmore, and then maybe it's just a little too far away. You thought it was going to be this immense thing, and it's too far away. So there you are. You're getting caught up in the circumstances. You're thinking maybe about North by Northwest, where the people are crawling all over the face of Mount Rushmore. Whatever it is, you have this idea of some gigantic thing, and then it doesn't seem to be as big a deal. Or I think about visiting the Art Institute of Chicago, and I went to the Impressionist exhibit. And they have, you know, if you are in Chicago and you haven't been to the Art Institute, you probably have been. It's one of the, you know, the tourist attractions in the city. But if you haven't been, you know, I recommend you go. Go to the Impressionism paintings. They have a really great collection. But what's interesting is when I was there, I almost didn't want to go to the Impressionism exhibit because there were so many people there. And all they did is they looked at the painting for a second, and then they looked at the tag, and then they shuffled over to the right, and they looked at the painting, and then they looked at the tag, and then they shuffled over to the right, and they looked at, and you could just feel a sense of being underwhelmed. Again, there's something is missing. Something is missing right here. And this can show up when we're reading Catcher in the Rye. It can show up when we're looking at Mount Rushmore. It can show up just as we're sitting at home and things don't seem to be satisfying for us. So thinking about what that student was looking for in Catcher in the Rye and what it is that perhaps we're asking of, what it is that's showing up, is we seem to think that there's something out there that needs to be transmitted to us. And that's the thing that we feel, that something is missing. We think about that student with that book. He was thinking inside Catcher in the Rye, there should be something that I can get, something that gets, I don't know, beamed or communicated to me. And if you think about that, that's still kind of complicated, because what it does is it leaves out what the reader is bringing to that relationship. You can read a story twice, two different points in your life, and it's going to be a very different story because of what it is you're bringing to the story. And it even includes previous readings of that story, but it includes all of the conditions of your life that are showing up with that rereading. Same thing with our lives. You go to mow the lawn, all the previous mowings that you've done are showing up in that mowing, but now here is the new mowing that's showing up. So we tend to think of reality as having something that we're supposed to get. And either we get them or we don't. But what's really happening in the act of reading is the act of reading itself. We tend to think of a reader and we tend to think of a book that has meaning to it. But you can't have a reader without the act of reading taking place. It makes no sense. So I'm a reader. People do that. They abstract and they go, I'm a reader. And that means they read. But a reader is actually one who's engaging in reading, just like a pedestrian is one who is walking. At that moment, you're a pedestrian. It'd be silly for me to say right now I'm a pedestrian, even though I walk a lot. So reading is the act, to be a reader is to read. For a book to say something, it needs to be read. So what we really don't have is that separation we feel we do, that there's a reader and there's a book. I mean, in relative reality, sure, that's what's going on, but what's actually taking place when we're talking about that experience of reading the book? And it is the reading. So stories, anything that's in a book, doesn't really belong to the reader or to the author or to the book. It belongs to the reading and the having been read. That sense of something missing showed up in another interchange that I had with a student. We were talking about, this is a student that I had in the class, a different student than the one I was talking about. But we were reading a short story, and I was kind of going into some of the ways that the story was it's a great story. I'm sure many of you have read it, The Things They Carried. And it's a very complex, very interesting, rich story about soldiers in Vietnam and the things they carry with them. And it has a lot more meaning to it than just the stuff they're carrying in their backpacks. And it has a richer meaning to it. And so we were reading the story and I was helping the students to open the story up. And one of my students, just finally in exasperation, just raised his hand. And he goes, I'm sorry, but I just don't think that this story is really that deep. And I laughed and I just said, well, you know, a story is as deep as its reader. And then he just said, oh, good one. But a story is as deep as its reader. And I want to start out and just kind of caution us about that word deep, first of all. He's the one who used it. And I just thought I would use the word he was using. The thing about depth is that it seems to suggest that, again, there's something that we have to get at that's not there. And when you're looking at a work of literature, what you have to work with are the words on the page and then the experience that that brings up as you're reading it. And there's a sense, and I think the student had it, that when you have a literary critic and they're talking about a text, that they're making stuff up, that they're digging through it and they're finding something that's not really there, something that's hidden. And again, we do that with reality too, when we feel something's missing. We feel that maybe we're not deep enough or that there's something under the surface of the appearances of reality, especially when you might hear teachings that appearances, the reality of appearances are just reality of appearances. And that we get caught up in them and we ascribe to them absolute truth. So then we think absolute truth is something underneath that. So I want to caution you about that. When I told that student that a story is as deep as its reader, what I really meant to say and what I was trying to do as a teacher of literature was to try to get my students to see the openness of a text that they encounter. And by that, I mean, if you think about, if you've ever tried to read Shakespeare and you're reading it and you're going, what is this guy talking about? I mean, that can be kind of challenging. He was a great poet, and sometimes that stuff is hard to get at. So the tendency, certainly the tendency I had when I was first reading Shakespeare, is to figure out what it's saying. And by that, I mean to close it down to a meaning, or maybe a couple meanings, but to bring that thing down so that I can figure out what's going on. But what I was trying to help my students to do is to open a text up, not to close it down. And again, when we think about reality, it's to see the openness of reality. When I say I was trying to get my students to open up a text, what I was really trying to get them to do wasn't that. It was to see the openness of the text itself, to try to refrain from trying to close it down. I say that because sometimes when I talk about openness of reality, I feel like I'm asking you to be open. But openness is how absolutely reality is showing up. It is showing up open, no borders, no boundaries. We conceptualize borders and boundaries. It appears that they're there, but absolutely no borders, no boundaries. So it's just to realize that openness. And that's what I try to get my students to do with reading. So when I'm talking about as deep as its reader, it's as open as you are to the openness of what's there. It's seeing all that's there rather than cutting off maybe the stuff you don't understand. And another thing that I used to harp on, I did beg your forgiveness at the beginning of the talk. So, but another thing that I used to talk to my students about was what they would do if they encountered a word they didn't know. Because what they would do is they would, well, they had some strategies, but if they're reading a text and there was a word in there they didn't know, they definitely would not look it up in a dictionary. That I knew because I would ask. What they would do is they'd just try to figure it out from the context, because that's what we do. Even though I told them, okay, do that first, because that's important. And then you look at the word and you try to compare it to other words and you think, well, it's sort of like this other word. So based on the context, it looks like it means that. But I would say you have to actually look that up in the dictionary so you can actually see what's there, rather than, again, taking, in this case, they're taking a previous word and applying it to the new word. So they have to look it up to really see what's going on. Because if you don't do that, and you get a word that you don't really know what it is, it's just going to be like noise in the text. So I read some very difficult passage by Cormac McCarthy, and all the words I knew they weren't going to know, I just substituted the word blah, 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 that sound. And I said, so the paragraph, until you look that up, it's, they went to the blah, 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 and they blah, 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 blah. Right? So how do you even make sense of that? Unless you actually see what's there. Again, with reality, we have a tendency to think we know what's going on, so we don't really see what's there. So with reading, as with life, it's to really wake up to the openness of what's there, to what's really there, rather than our ideas about what it is. When we hear something like that, when we hear about being open to the openness of reality, about seeing all that's there, about waking up, I think there is still, if we're still clinging on to this idea of something missing, there still ends up being in there that something missing. Do you know what I'm saying? It still echoes inside of that if we're still carrying that around with us. And it is a subtle feeling. It is something that we actually very often, you know, it's dukkha. And it's just, a moment can show up and there can be dukkha, a moment can show up and we can be released from dukkha, a moment can show up, there can be dukkha. And again, dukkha is just that sense that something's not there. And we can do that with this sense of realizing the openness of reality, seeing all there is, waking up to life, because then we think, oh yeah, if I do that, if I'm open to reality, if I see the openness of reality, if I wake up to life, then I'm going to get that thing, that something special that I'm missing. And that's something special, you know, in our practice has a lot of names, but enlightenment is probably one that we've heard of. Again, we don't have to apply that term to what I'm describing. It can just be we feel like something is missing from our life, and now we're going to do something that our idea is it's going to help us to see what we're missing. You know, that's the way we might re-understand what we're doing. So we still have at the bottom of it a sense that something is missing and that what I'm going to do is going to give me that something. And that something is missing because it's missing, because we don't have it. When we find it, we just know it's going to be good. We just know it's going to be good. So again, think about that kid in that station wagon going to the Black Hills and going to Mount Rushmore, and this has got to be good. And then it's just so small. it's not a big deal. So we do this a lot. And I want to read another passage from Suzuki. That's from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's from a completely different chapter. But interestingly enough, he's talking about this sense of nothing special that we now inscribe when we might take up a practice like this, or when we are engaging with this idea, that the sense that we have that something is missing. And I want to read to, because he's talking about the tendency we have then to ascribe specialness to realizing that nothing's missing. And he talks about the same poem that he talked about in the other passage, but he gives it a different translation that actually makes clearer, I think, the dismissiveness of that poem to experience. So here's Suzuki. He says, if you continue this simple practice every day, and he's just talking about coming back to this, fully coming back to this present reality, Zazen. If you continue this simple practice every day, you will obtain a wonderful power. Before you attain it, it is something wonderful. I'm going to reread that just to kind of get an inflection I think he's getting at here. If you continue this simple practice every day, you will obtain a wonderful power. Before you attain it, it is something wonderful. But after you obtain it, it is nothing special. It is just you yourself, nothing special. As a Chinese poem says, I went and I returned. It was nothing special. Rosan, famous for its misty mountains, Secco for its water. People think it must be wonderful to see the famous range and the water said to cover the earth. If you go there, you'll just see water and mountains, nothing special. It is a kind of mystery that for people who have no experience of enlightenment, enlightenment is something wonderful. But if they attain it, it is nothing. But
looks like we maybe lost connection a little bit. Is that, are other people losing the connection? Okay. All right. He sent me a message and that he's going to try something else. So we'll see if he pops online again here.
All right. I'm back. Can you hear me?
Yep. We hear you. So it was just a minute or so. Take it away.
I think I know it about the point that I was, I believe. So we're just talking about that poem again and talking about people thinking that these ranges are going to be, these mountain ranges shrouded in mist, are going to be something wonderful, and that the water is going to be beautiful. And they go there, it's just water, it's just mountains, and it's nothing special. And then he went on, and this is where I think I got cut off. Suzuki says, it is kind of a mystery that for people who have no experience of enlightenment, enlightenment is something wonderful. But if they attain it, it is nothing. But yet, it is not nothing. Do you understand? And that's where I got kicked off, as I was just pointing out. Do you understand is a question that Suzuki points out to us again and again. Do you understand? He says, for a mother with children, having children is nothing special. That is Zazen. So if you continue this practice more and more, you will acquire something. Nothing special, but nevertheless something. You may say universal nature or Buddha nature or enlightenment. You may call it by many names, but for the person who has it, it is nothing and it is something. And this gets to what I think he was pointing out in that earlier passage when he was talking about experiencing this reality as if it were something we already knew. We do that. What we already know is reality. That's what we already know. That's the part of our experience that we overlook, is the fact that this is always here. This is always here because it seems to be changing. But no matter what's changing, it's just this. It's just this. And so that's why it's nothing special. It's nothing that's not here already. It's nothing you have to go get. It's nothing you don't already have. Though we will act as if we don't already have it. We'll think, I'm missing something here. Am I missing something here? Something's missing. And then we go looking for it. And then we think, well, if I get it, then it's going to be something special. It's going to be something wonderful. And yet it's always right here already. So we're going to, you know, maybe take up this practice, maybe do some readings and think that something special is going to be revealed to us. And then we won't have that sense of missing something. We'll feel like nothing is missing. And that's going to be great. That's going to be something special. And there's that thing, like I told you. Right at the heart of the practice is still that sense that something is missing and that I need to get it. And that Suzuki's showing us isn't really what's happening. And this is something special in that most of us, again, move through our life as if we are missing something. So waking up to what's fully here, seeing what's here, seeing the munificence of each moment, living that, that is something special. But it's not something special. It's just this. It's just what's showing up. But it is special in a way because most of us, again, don't live out of this. Most of us are living out of that past circumstance that's like this, and then we're comparing, and then we're getting a sense of which one was better, which one was worse, and whether this one's boring or whether this one has something that the other one doesn't have. and then we're kicked out of this. We're not really kicked out of it, but we feel like we are. We feel like something's missing. So it is something. It is something wonderful, as he says, and yet it's nothing special. And we have a lot of teachings that help us to see that it's just this world. There's nothing special that is enlightenment. It's just realizing this, not our ideas of it, but just this. There's a koan that I like from the Gateless Gate. It's the 18th case of the Gateless Gate, and it's called Tozan's 3 pounds. It's very short and just goes like this. A monk asked Tozan when he was weighing some flax, "What is Buddha?" Tozan said, "This flax weighs 3 pounds." And that's one of those exchanges when you hear it, you go, of course, that's what Zen teachers do, right? What is Buddha? This flax weighs 3 pounds. What is that supposed to mean? Well, there's a lot of things we can look at. First of all, we look at that question, what is Buddha? What is it the students are asking about? And they're asking about Buddha in that sense of Buddha nature, of reality. What is reality? Can you tell me what reality is? And so if you think about Tozan's answer, just at some level, he's showing the monk that this really, that's an unanswerable question. How do you answer that? If you put it into those terms, what is reality? You already start to see that that's just nothing you can say. Now, when we take up these teachings, we realize, of course, people will try to say it. But when we take up these teachings, we realize that reality, taking up these teachings is taking up this practice. We see reality is not something that really can be put into words. Once you put it into words, you've already started to reduce it. You've already started to put an interpretation on it. As I was saying, when you approach Shakespeare, you can reduce it down to that one or two meanings, or you can realize the openness of it. When you're using words, it becomes more difficult to see that openness, right? We start to get an interpretation there, and we interpret those words. So in a way, Tozan's response is, he doesn't give that answer to that student. Reality is this. Instead, he says, this flax weighs 3 pounds. He's pointing, for the student, he's pointing directly to reality. What is it that Tozan is doing? He's weighing some flax. So what is Buddha? What is reality? It weighs 3 pounds right here. This is what's showing up. This is how reality is appearing right now. The world of appearances is not something that's, like I said, it's not this fake thing. It's certainly in Western metaphysics, there's this idea that appearances are somehow false and that they need to be, you know, seen through to get to the truth, to get to the depth. But that's not it at all. Right here, in what's showing up, absolute reality is manifesting itself in whatever is showing up. Now, we will take whatever is showing up and think that is reality. And we think Tozan is telling us then that, I don't know, if you look at what he says this flax weighs 3 pounds. He's got an experience going on there. Rather than just pointing to the flax and saying that, though teachers have done that too. The oak tree in the front yard is another teaching. What's the nature of reality? What is reality? The oak tree in the front yard. It's right here. But rather than overlay our ideas, okay, the oak tree in the front yard, I've seen this before. I know what this is. I'm looking for that something special, teach. I want the juice. You know, I want you to show me that thing that I'm missing. And the teacher just points right back to this. Not your ideas of it, but to what's really here, the openness of what this is. And really the impermanence of what this is. Because if you look at what Tozan's doing, it's just what's showing up right there. That's reality, what's showing up. And this flax weighs 3 pounds, but if you ask him in another 2 minutes, it's not going to be the answer. It'd be anything that's showing up doesn't even have to be that. You can come up with a completely different way of pointing toward reality that is this life that seems to unfold with these events. So now we get back then to this student, a catcher in the rye. What am I missing? And I just want to tell you what my answer is, because like I said, it was a bit curmudgeonly or pugnacious or however you want to put it, but what am I missing? And my answer was fortitude. So I'm going to tell him what the catcher in the rye was about, but I was just kind of saying the fortitude to just be there with that book that you maybe didn't like so much. But I have to admit, I don't think I would answer that question the same way today. That just seemed like I was trying to bloody somebody's nose there by saying that. The way that I would answer that question today, a catcher in the rye, what am I missing? Or in my life, what am I missing? I'd say, good question. Good question. Be with that question. See what's actually showing up in that question. What is it that you're expecting? What is it that you think should be there that's not? And what is actually showing up? So it's a good question. Just be there with that. That's what's showing up at this moment, is that question. What am I missing? Good question. So it's not that you're missing enlightenment. Enlightenment is right here. So what am I missing? Yeah, take a good look. See what's there and see if you are missing something. That practice that Suzuki was talking about, that simple practice of Zazen. He says, if you continue the simple practice every day of just coming back to this moment, to the openness of moment, to the fullness of this moment, if you just come back to that every day, you will obtain a wonderful power. And that's just realizing all that's here. It's realizing the fullness of reality. And even that kind of suggests something that I don't want to suggest. It's living this moment out fully. And when we take up our practice then, that's how we can do it, is just to be here fully in this moment. Rather than to take up this practice with that little niggling thing at the bottom of it, that what am I missing? Now, a lot of us start this practice that way. Something is missing. I think I've said plenty of times in my talks that one of the things that brought me to this practice was a sense of anxiety that I had. And I actually had a therapist who said, oh, you should take up this practice to get rid of your anxiety. And so I kind of had that in the back of my mind. But then I started listening to the teachings and what the teachers were pointing to. And they would say something like, well, you know, nothing is gained from sitting meditation, or sitting meditation is useless. And I remember when I first heard that, I just said, well, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But I just listened to that and I thought, okay, I'm also going to let go of, well, I don't quite understand what the teachers are pointing to. I'm going to let go of my plan to be rid of anxiety at this moment. I'm just going to let go of that. I mean, if that happens, that's great. I'm going to just sit. I'm just going to try to be present with every moment. You know, pay attention to my breath at the beginning. It's funny because that's the way, you know, that's what I did. But, you know, underneath all that still was that sense of wanting to get something. And I know that because there'd be moments I'd be sitting on my cushion and it would feel wonderful. I just feel like a moment of a weight lifting off of me or bliss. And I go, that's it. That's the thing. See, that's what was missing. So now I know what it is. When I sit on my cushion again, that's what I have to have. That's what this is all about, that we're supposedly not getting, you know, we're supposedly not trying to get this. And so what I did for a while after feeling something like that is then I would sit and I would try to get that to come back again. You see, something's missing there again. Am I missing something? Where is it? Where is that feeling? Right now, I'm just kind of frustrated. Instead of being that frustration that's showing up, I'm trying to get rid of the frustration by getting back to that thing that I feel like it's missing. And so I take up this to try to do something, because it makes no sense to us to do something without gaining something from it, right? It makes no sense to take up some kind of practice if you're not going to gain something from it. And in fact, then I've heard people say, they tell me sort of confidentially, say something like, well, I know we're not supposed to gain something from meditation, but, you know, and then they tell me what they gain from meditation. And you just kind of go, well, you know, that might have arisen. But again, it's not that you're not supposed to say that. It just wake up to that. Wake up to that need that you have to have gotten something from it, because that gets back at the heart of a sense that something is missing, that we do things only if we think we're going to gain something from them. I want to share one last story with you. I know I've been going on a little bit here, but it really kind of gets to the heart of that. And it's another literature story. And it was a conversation I had with a young man, a very bright young man. And he was telling me that he had the novel Moby Dick assigned to him in an English class. I love Moby Dick, so I was excited that he was reading Moby Dick. And I asked him, I said, what do you think of the book so far? And he goes, oh, it's really entertaining. I really love it. And I go, oh, that's great. Yeah, because it opens. It's very fun. Anyhow, I was curious to see how he responded to the book. And probably about a month later, I just said, what do you think of Moby Dick? He goes, I didn't read it past the first two chapters. And I went, well, I thought you were enjoying it. He goes, yeah, I was. But, you know, the teacher just assigned us the book. He didn't really tell us what we were going to get from reading it. And I went, what? He said, well, he didn't really tell us what we were going to get from reading the book, so I just decided I wasn't really worth my time. And I just thought, well, that's the craziest thing that I've ever heard, but it's what we do. Why do it if you're not going to get something from it? And of course, what he's missing and what we can see in, say, reading Moby Dick is that it's not, again, that Moby Dick has just got something and it's going to hand it to us. You know, it's rather that the care that we take to the act of reading that book, right? The depth with which we read it, if I can use that word depth, you know, how deep are you as its reader? But really, how you are open, allow the text to be open and allow yourself to be open to the text and meet it and fully experience that and give it that care. That is the worth of reading Moby Dick. You see, the care that you invest in this moment is where the value comes from. So it's a very generous act. It's giving your full attention. It's living fully this moment. That's where the value comes from. All that other stuff we think we're going to get from it, I don't know what you'd think you'd get from Moby Dick. There's a very long section where he argues that a whale is actually a fish. And I don't know what I'm supposed to get from that. But, you know, what it is you think you're supposed to get from it, that's neither here nor there. You know, if my anxiety is released as I'm practicing meditation, you know, that's just fine and dandy. But the real practice is just to fully invest in this, fully be this moment. That's it. Everything else takes care of itself. You don't have to judge whether or not, I'm not getting that feeling back again. I guess I'm not doing this. You don't have to do that. Just be here with what this is. And of course, that is difficult when it feels like something essential or something necessary is missing. We feel like, I'm not getting this. But if I've made this clear enough in the way that I've been talking about this, one of the difficulties there, I'm not getting something, is the sense we have that there's something out there that I can get something from. And I'm talking about just fully experiencing this right now, just fully living this moment and getting rid of the me who's doing this. Because then you can actually see the fullness, the totality that's showing up. When we experience this as I'm experiencing this, you've already removed yourself from reality. I'm out here experiencing reality. You might not think of it intellectually that way, but that is how you're going about your life, is I'm experiencing this. I'm outside of that. That's something that I have to get something from. But if we just fully live this experience, we'll see the fullness of this experience. That includes that thing we call me, that if we tried to define what that was, we couldn't even really say what it is anyhow. Then we can realize that nothing is missing. So that's the conclusion of my talk. I thank you all for listening, especially to so many literary examples.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, I think we can open it for questions here again, just to give you a second to reorient yourself for that hand raising option that's down. If you click on participants, and then I'll see your hand raised. And I see Michael Jordan has his hand up, so you can go ahead, Michael.
Steve, first of all, I enjoyed your talk. I'm still involved in that game I call teaching. And kind of a variation on what you were saying. There are times when we'll be reading something, or I'll ask students to read something in class, and I'll say, well, you know, what are you thinking right now? I mean, what's your response to this thing? Trying to open it up, and we'll go around the classroom, and it's just amazing how people will experience it differently as we're reading it in class. And I think this is wonderful. People are just opening up to this. They're experiencing this right now. And then someone will raise his or her hand and say, this is nice, Professor Jordan, but is this going to be on the exam? And so even as I was listening to, I thought, you know, even when you think you've reached that point or you think you've opened something up or they're opening up to something, there is still this sense, and I'm guilty of it as well, that you need to be legitimated, that somebody has to come in and say, oh, yeah, that's what's going to be on the exam. But if you get that, then, well, then what? You know. So anyway, thank you. I appreciated your talk, and it made me feel as if I'm not as much of a curmudgeon as maybe I thought I was. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, thank you for your comments, Michael. Yeah, that's absolutely it. And I'm with you. I still carry this around, too. We all do. You know, it's just something we can wake up to, that need to, you were saying, that legitimate, you know, to have it legitimized, or to get a sense that there's something there that's right, that's the right way. You know, I think about the way you open your discussions up, and that's the way I would do it too, is I would ask people what their responses were. And it would be this open, interesting field of discussion, but students would want to nail it down to a particular reading. They'd want to know, is this going to be in a test? How can I get the answer that's going to be on the test? So anyhow, I'm just thanking you, Michael. Yeah, I certainly experienced that. And that's something that I think we all can have a tendency to do from moment to moment. So yeah, thanks for sharing.
I see Ken is next on the list for a question.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for the talk. I hope I've not got completely the wrong end of the stick here, but I just noticed, obviously, that you're making a lot of references to literature. I wonder, though, if we can use all sorts of different forms of art as an example. I remember, this is more of a comment than a question, I remember some years ago, I was working with a young lad who was trying desperately to learn jazz saxophone. And his teachers kept sending him away with all of the recordings from the greats, people like John Coltrane's, etc. And he kept coming back, and he used exactly the same phrase that you were using, which is what's reminded me. He said, "I don't get it. Am I missing something here? I've gone away. I've listened to this. I've learned all of the chord changes. I can play all of the patterns. I've analysed what the drummer's playing, and I'm a better player because of that, but it's just sound. Why is this a great piece of music?" And this went on for a while until one of his teachers actually turned around to him and gave him another recording and said, "Take this away and just listen." And a week later, sure enough, he came back and he said, "This is the best piece of music that I've ever heard." He said, "It's absolutely fantastic." And the guy who was teaching him said, pretty much looked at us all and said, "I've cracked it." But then the student actually spoiled it all, because he then turned around and said, "You know, it's such a great piece of music. I'm going to spend the next couple of days actually analysing all the chord sequences and the scales and the patterns that are being used." And just lost it. And I just wanted to share that, really.
Yeah, thanks for sharing, Ken. Absolutely. So we want to do that thing with it. And again, you know, this is not just art. So you're right, any kind of art form it works with, but it's our life too. We want to kind of summarize our experience or encapsulate it into some kind of intellectual response. It sounds like that's what that student wanted to do with the music. And that somehow in doing that, he was gonna get something out of it that he wasn't getting, that he didn't even realize he actually was getting. It sounds like with that one recording, because he got it, but then he didn't trust that was, something seemed still was missing, even though he didn't say that. And he felt he needed to go and intellectualize and try to understand it intellectually to get it, to really get it. Yeah, you know, jazz reminds me there's a story Randy Potterbaum, one of our Songhound members here, has shared with me about Miles Davis. And I guess the musician asked Miles Davis something like, "Well, what do you want me to play?" And Miles said, "Do you know how to play that thing?" Pointing at the guy's horn. And the guy said, "Yeah, I do." And he goes, "Well, forget everything you know about it." That's what he wants. Just forget everything you know. Get rid of that headiness and just sort of play with showing up. And it'll take care of itself. So, yeah, thanks for sharing, Ken.
Well, it looks like we're right at 11. So just want to thank Steve for your talk today.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.